Let yourself get in a comfortable position, your body relax, and just take some deep breaths. And give your mind a few moments just to simply relax. In your non-judgmental, friendly, caring presence. So if you can evoke that part of yourself, that the part that is so caring and loving to others, to friends, to family, to clients, evoke that part of yourself and let that part simply be present to the width of your mind as it relaxes and thinks whatever it wants to think, feels whatever it wants to feel without any judgment. Just give it a few minutes. And witness the physical body with that same attitude. Feel the body and mind just expand outward in its process of relaxing, as though simply letting go of any stress or tension that gives the experience of expanding out into space. Because you're not holding on to anything or asking anything to be different. Your whole being simply blends in with the environment because you're not singling out anything or asking anything to be one way or another. And that way your whole body and mind, your breath, everything just simply blends in and is held by the environment of which it is a part. If you as the witness have an inner stance of objective, non-judgmental, non-demanding inner warmth, the body and mind are free to relax in that environment. Notice your mind and your body enjoying and relaxing in that attitude, that non-judgmental, caring attitude. What a relief. What a relief it is for the mind. If your mind has some concerns or worries, find that part of yourself that is objective and interested and wants to help. And just allow yourself to listen and be present to those concerns and worries as a helpful friend, just as you would do for others who needed your help or came to you with their problems. As a non-judgmental, helpful friend, see if you can be totally present, non-rejecting, totally present to whatever it is the mind is feeling, thinking, concerned about, without pushing away, just simply totally present. As an objective and loving friend, non-judgmental, objective, loving friend. And feel the body and mind relax. In that inner environment. Now see if you can let that objective, warm, non-judgmental presence also just expand, as though expand and relax into the environment, and at the environment, the mind, the body, perceptions, all be held and relax into that. Whatever the thoughts or sensations, allow them to be, but just let them simply relax and be contained in that silent, objective presence. Let that silent, objective presence of the inner friend simply relax and expand out into space. And let yourself simply relax into the warmth of that presence. Don't cling to any thoughts, just simply let them relax. Totally relax into that presence of your own being. Imagine your mind and your body sinking deeply, relaxing into that silent presence, that silent warmth. Feel it sinking and relaxing, resolving into the presence. Deeply sinking into that relaxed space. Where you can simply be. The body relax out into space. Let the mind totally relax. Yourself just relax into your own silent presence. You're not trying to achieve anything or go anywhere or experience anything, other than just simply relaxing. And just being with yourself as you are. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Sahaviryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. From verse 9 of Epistamaika. Yatha surya ekops vanekas chalasu. Yatha surya ekops vanekas chalasu. Stira swapya nan vakvipavya swarupaha. Stira swapya nan vakvipavya swarupaha. Chalasu prapinnasu tishwevamekaha. Chalasu prapinnasu tishwevamekaha. Sanityopalabdhi swarupo hamatma. Sanityopalabdhi swarupo hamatma. Sandhi. Yatha suryaha ekaha apsu anekaha chalasu. Stirasu api ananvak vibhavya swarupaha. Chalasu prabhinnasu dhishu evam ekaha. Saha nitya upalabdhi swarupaha aham atma. So yatha, just as suryaha, the sun, just as the sun, which is ekaha, is one. So yatha suryaha ekaha, just as the sun, which is one, apsu, in the waters, anekaha, many. I'll go through the words and then put it more into a meaningful sentence. Anekaha means many. So just as the suryaha, the sun, ekaha, one, apsu, in the waters, anekaha, many, chalasu, moving, in the waters which are chalasu, which are moving, stirasu api, also still. So just as the sun, which is one, in the waters which are moving and which are still, the still and moving waters, okay? Ananvak vibhavya swarupaha. Just as this one sun, which is many, right? It becomes many in the moving waters, right? In the moving and the still waters. In all of these waters, some are moving, some are still. The sun becomes many. But this one sun, which becomes many, anandak vibhavya swarupaha, the one sun, its swarupa, its nature, doesn't change to follow after this reflection, right? So the reflections become many. This one sun appears as though becoming many, right? In all of these waters, some are still, some of the waters are stira, they're very still. Some are chala, they're moving. But in all of these waters, the sun is being reflected, right? And the reflected condition of the sun is going to be different. It's going to be different in the moving waters, and it's going to be different in the still waters. And in any case, it's going to be more than one, right? So for every body of water that's reflecting the sun, there's going to be one sun there. And that sun that is reflected is going to be taking on the conditions of the water. Moving water, moving sun. Still water, still sun. Muddy water, muddy sun. Clear water, clear sun. See? And so this sun that is many in all of these waters, some still and some moving, this sun, its swarupa, its nature, the nature of the sun itself, vibhavya means to change or to modify. Ananvak vibhavya. It doesn't go through this modification in light of, in imitating the reflection. Ananvak means to follow after. So the swarupa, anvak means to follow after. Ananvak means not to do that. So the swarupa, its nature, right? Does it change? Does it become something else following after the reflection, right? So it doesn't follow, its nature doesn't change following after the reflection, okay? So yata suryaha eka, the sun, just as the sun is one, how its nature doesn't change following after the many reflections in the clear, in the still, in the moving waters. Chalasu prabhinnasu dishu evam ekaha. Evam, in the same manner, saha ekaha, that which is one. See, that which is one is that atma which is one, that self which is one. In the same manner, dishu, in the buddhis, in all of the minds, right? Prabhinnasu, each being different from the other. Prabhinnasu dishu, in all of the minds which are different. Bhinna means divided. This mind, this mind, this mind, this mind. So in all of the many different minds, chalasu, all of which are moving. Right? There is no buddhi. There is no mind that's not moving. Right? So chalasu, prabhinnasu, dishu, in the buddhis, in the minds, all of which are moving, all of which are different, in the same way that the sun is only one and does not take on the changes which the reflection takes on. In that same way, this Atma, which is Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupaha Aham Atma, Aham Atma, I am that self, whose nature is Nitya Upalabdhi Swarupa, whose nature is consciousness, the conscious being which is Nitya, which is changeless, which is timeless. Nitya means timeless, free from time. So I am that Atma, whose being is timeless consciousness, right? Timeless consciousness, that being which is timeless consciousness, which is one alone, right? In all of the various buddhis, all of which are changing, and all of which one is different from the another. So just as the sun remains the same, reflecting all of the different bodies of water, and doesn't follow after the reflection, right? Doesn't follow, it doesn't imitate, the sun doesn't imitate these reflections. Okay? Like that, myself does not follow after the changing mind, the many and varied changing minds. My mind, one mind, is many and varied. Right? Thought after thought after thought, mood after mood after mood, emotion after emotion after emotion. My being doesn't follow after that one mind, nor does it follow after any mind. The one being that illumines all minds, all of which are changing and modifying in various different ways. Myself doesn't change its nature to imitate or to take on the condition of that reflected, as a reflected consciousness. Okay, so, see these verses in Hastamalaka, but in all of the Upanishads, all are circling around this recognition of the stable being of yourself. The one who is not away from your mind, but is the very luminary, the very conscious being that is present to the mind, that illumines the mind. Like the sun illumines all objects, the one that gives light to all objects itself, never changing, right? Like that, I give light to the mind, right? But the example that's so important in reference to the sun, he's going to do something with it in this next verse, but for now, the example that's so important for the sun is the fact that the sun indiscriminately illumines whatever is in its sphere. It's indiscriminate. It is not performing a function. It's not saying, well, let me illumine this now, and let me illumine that, and let me illumine that. No. It's because the sun is luminosity itself. Right? It is light itself. Whatever is in its sphere is equally lit. Right? And some of the things in its sphere reflect it. Like, for instance, waters as opposed to stone. Or waters or mirrors or any reflecting surface. Right? Any reflecting surface will reflect the sun. But the reflection of the sun, therefore the reflection of the sun is going to be many and varied. Some reflections will be clear and kind of true, a true reflection to the sun. It's still. Even say the water is very, very clear. We can say, oh, that's a clear, true reflection. That reflection of the sun looks like the sun. Okay? It looks like the sun. Okay? Where in a muddy water, right, or an agitated water, it doesn't look like the sun. Right? It's a dimmed version of the sun. It's a breaking up, ecstatic or splitting up version of the sun. It doesn't truly look like the sun. But whether it looks like the sun, and so therefore is enjoying some harmony, if it were to speak, you could say, you know, I am perfect as I am, you know, and the muddy sun, the muddy water could say, oh, I'm just feeling so depressed, I'm just not very shiny today, you know. It can be having those kind of thoughts and those kinds of identifications. But the reality is that the luminary, the sun itself, is not going through any type of modification whatever. Whatever the water, whatever the reflection is doing, whatever the body of water is doing, whatever modification is going on there in reference to the body of water, has zero impact on the sun. It's not even a little bit. You know, like you could say, oh, look at this water is so muddy. The water is so muddy. You know, the sun's not even reflecting in that water. You know, the poor sun. The poor sun is not reflecting in that water. How horrible for it. You know, it's an agony. It must be an agony. You know. Well, we could say, you know, that if that water wants to be reflecting the sun, it could be very disappointed, right? If the water wants to be reflecting the sun, if it could say, oh, I'm so muddy, I'm not reflecting the sun, it can say that, you know. I want to be in a different condition so that I can reflect the sun. I would be happier if I was reflecting the sun. This is the water talking. I would be happier if I was clean and pure so that the reflection of the sun, you know, would be bright. You know, so that I would feel bright. I can maybe talk like that, you know. But in reality, from the standpoint of the sun, no matter how muddy the water is, or how agitated the water is, or how pure the water is, from the standpoint of the sun, it has zero effect. It does not dim me. It does not dim the sun or change the sun in any way. And so now, for us, just like the sun, difference here is the sun's way up in the sky, casting down its light. So there's a difference. The sun is away, and here are the bodies of water that are far away from it. That's where the drishtanta doesn't work. But that's not the idea here. Sun is standing for consciousness. Sun is standing for you. The conscious being. By conscious being, it's not some conscious being that you have to try to reach. It's the conscious being that you are. The conscious being that says, I am. Okay? The I am, the one that the words I am, let me put it this way, the ones that the words I am refer to. Right? So why this verse? Well, what is the verse trying to unfold to make you see? Well, it's that our identity is always with the water. You know? We take the condition of the mind, right, to be the condition of the one that's illumining it. And so, therefore, when the mind is muddy, when the mind is depressed, or the mind is agitated, or the mind is happy, or ecstatic, or hateful, you know, or dull, I become these things. I am dull, I am hateful, I am happy, I am ecstatic, etc. The ahankara, the I notion, takes myself, the sun, that's illumining equally and indiscriminately all of these changing conditions without any change to itself whatsoever. My being is there as the constant that illumines every single thought modification that I have, right? Indiscriminately, without being changed in any way, by the thought modification. And this, in fact, is your very experience. It's just not, it needs to be pointed out. Your inner experience is only this. The me, the self, yourself, the I, the conscious me, the one that you think, when you say I am, that one that you are talking about, that self-experience is the sun. It never modifies in any way whatsoever. It remains the stable luminary of all the vrittis, all of the thoughts that take place, not only in your mind, but in all minds. But let's look at just your mind for now. And so what needs to happen in terms of self-knowledge is that this sun, the luminary, you know, the one that gives the consciousness, the one that is the conscious being, that lights up the mind, that is aware of the mind, that stable me has to be recognized and differentiated from the changing moods and emotions and conditions of the mind. Right? And it is there to be recognized. You know, this is not some big deal that we want. We think with so huge words like enlightenment means it should be this horrendous thing that, of course, none of us are qualified for. You need a different body. You need a different buddhi. You need a different type of upadhi. You should have been born in India. You should be a sannyasi. You should be something else other than just you. Right? That's not true. That's a lot of baggage, and it's also a big excuse. By the time you get to knowledge, by the time your karma is such, this is the whole Hindu tradition, the whole tradition of the Advaita Vedanta, so the Upanishadic tradition. By the time your mind, who you are, actually starts asking, who am I? What is going on? Is there anything about me that is real? By the time your mind starts asking this question, you become, by the asking of that question, by that wanting to know, a person who is qualified to gain this knowledge. That is what a mumukshu is. It's the whole Brahma Sutras in the first, first sutra. Who is the one qualified to gain this knowledge? It's the one who, because of crores of punya, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, you know, of punya that gives your mind the actual equipoise or self-reflectiveness to actually ask this question. Because otherwise, in your mind, in your experience, you are an intelligent, good, fine person who has the answer. I just need another car. I just need another job. I just need to get to advance. I need this, or I need that, or I need that, and everything will be fine. Good people, intelligent people, saintly people, you know, capable people, are not necessarily mumukshus. They're strong, capable, good, saintly people, but still have not understood this one simple. Not simple. It's very difficult until you get it. But once you get it, it's so obvious, you know, that none of this works. That I cannot. It is absolutely impossible in the creation to achieve any type of stability or to discover the wholeness that is not subject to being taken away. It is not possible in the creation to achieve that. And then I want to know, you throw your hands up to Ishwara, to the Lord. Because you have realized that there are certain limitations in what you seek as an individual, that you yourself are incapable, and the universe is incapable, not because you're stupid or because you're a failure, but because the universe can't do it. The universe and your body, mind, sense organs, and the universe cannot provide that type of stability by its very nature. When you realize that, you become somebody who's desirous of liberation. Say, God, if you're there, then please tell me what this is all about. That's considered, that mumukshutvam is considered very, very sacred and rare. But if you have that question now, to you it's just normal. You don't say, oh, I'm so sacred and rare because I have this question. But the Upanishads will look at you as sacred and rare. Your teachers will honor you in India. You said they'll honor the whole tradition because it is sacred and rare. It's not that you have to be walking on air or have all kinds of spiritual highfalutin experiences. You can have those too, or you cannot have them. It's irrelevant. It is irrelevant in this way. Does the sun change because it has especially clear experiences or especially muddy experiences? The mind may change. That's not the question. Does the sun change? And the answer is no, it doesn't. And it's the sun that needs to be recognized. Yourself is what needs to be known. You can, for lifetimes, purify your mind and have all kinds of wonderful experiences. You can purify your body, you know, and become, you know, and have yoga postures and purity, purity, purity. There's nothing wrong in it. And a pure mind, just like the sun reflecting a clear water bucket reflecting the sun, it has peace. A healthy body has physical peace. A healthy mind that practices Dharma, right, has peace. Relative peace. Relative peace subject to change. Relative health subject to death. It's all relative. But yet, you know, you can achieve relative peace. Higher and higher and higher and higher levels of relative peace. Like a yogi in Sankhya Yoga can be practicing, spend a lifetime working on the practice of meditative experiences, the practice of samadhi. So I could spend most of my life sitting, practicing with pranayama, breathing exercises, and then having a very very controlled life, practicing also dharma, you know, proper behavior, proper attitudes. These are good things. There's nothing wrong with them, you know. And I'm much happier internally practicing dharma than not practicing. But I could also sit for hours and hours in deep meditation and have a mind with doing plenty of pranayama that's enjoying peace. And so now my life is dedicated to maintaining a clear water bucket. That's what I'm doing. I am maintaining a clear, clean water bucket through the practice of proper attitudes and the practice of keeping a beautiful environment for myself, of doing exercises to keep the mind as silent and absorbed as possible. And so then I spend my life doing that, and I can spend the next life doing that, and the next life, and the next life, and the next life. You know, at some point I'm going to ask, who is the one doing this? Do I have to go on for infinite number of lifetimes maintaining the clear water bucket? Everything that you're maintaining is something that, if you don't maintain it, is subject to becoming muddy. That's why even in yoga, they say that you have to be diligent in your practice, because otherwise, and they use this example, otherwise, like a bouncing ball, boink, 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 you will bounce that back down into samsara. Right? Maintenance, okay, but that isn't liberation. You're maintaining and working for states of experience. Okay, that's fine, as long as you know what you're doing. What if you said to me, I know, that's exactly what I'm doing because I like that. That's fine. I like it too. I think it's nice. I think practicing Dharma is nice. I like meditation. I like to be absorbed, just keep my mind with myself. I like that. Maybe I could do it for hours. Maybe I'll retire into that. That is so much different, though, than thinking that you will attain moksha, liberation, from this practice of maintaining conditions that are themselves bound to change. The mumukshu, who is the one who has recognized that is not possible. It's possible to a degree to maintain, but you're having to maintain or it'll fall apart on you. I would like to know, is there anything that doesn't need to be maintained? Can I just be free? Is there anything that is free? That is free from time, that's free, not going to change on me? Where I can just relax and say, you know, all right, all that, I've done everything that needs to be done, I can relax now. No more maintaining. And that's moksha. That's recognition of the self that doesn't need to be maintained. That self that is this nitya upalabdhi swarupa atma. Upalabdhi means conscious. So the atma, yourself. So Hasta Malaka says here, aham atma, I am the atma, I am the self, me, this self that I am. Let's put it this way. Hasta, he says, this self that I am, aham atma, this self that I am, my nature, my swarupa, my being, is upalabdhi, is consciousness, which is nitya. It's timeless. It doesn't come and it doesn't go. Like the sun doesn't come and go, it doesn't stop shining and then shine, right? Consciousness is something which is non-objectifiable. It's free from time. The being that I am, it's the being that I always am and always will be. It's not a being that is coming and going. It's not a being that is subject to time, that is subject to change. This self that I am is eternal. Eternal not eternal in the sense of ongoing. Eternal in the sense of changeless. Eternal in the sense of timeless. And this eternal me, this nitya, this conscious being, this one is the one that illumines all minds, all thoughts, all moods, all emotions, all of the changing experiences that are there, itself remaining changeless. In the last verse, we went from the eyes to Vivaswat to Ishwara. We made a jump to Ishwara. Here, again, this verse releases you again from, in terms of consciousness, from the individual buddhi, the individual mind. Because if this self that I am is not bound or changed by this mind, it is asanga. Asanga means it's not attached. It's not attached to it. Right? If this mind, if all of the thoughts and moods and emotions and perceptions that belong to this mind are changing and coming and going, become still and then become active, become still, become active, happy, sad, whatever they are, they go on changing. If I am the luminary and these are the illumined, this luminary, the conscious me, is not contained by or attached to this mind or this body or these sense organs or this world. All of which are known. That's why we do so spend so much painstaking effort going through the seer-seen relationship. If I'm seeing it, if I watch these things come and go, my being's not coming and going. If a condition can leave, an emotion can come and go and I remain, I'm not that. It's not possible. Why isn't it possible? Because if I'm here and it's gone, that's why. So it's a no-brainer. If I am here, the me remains, and as conditions change, there's an asangaha, there's a non-attachment, right? A non-relationship to those conditions. If there's no attachment there to these conditions that come and go, then I am not bound by that mind or the body or the sense organs. Or any perception. And so therefore, what makes the conscious being me that I can't objectify and look at as an object? What makes this conscious being different from the conscious being, the me that illumines your mind and your mind and your mind? That's why it says this consciousness that is the luminary of all minds, just like the sun illumines all, you know, bodies of water indiscriminately. Myself illumines all minds indiscriminately. Right? Because the attachment, so-called, only comes from the standpoint of the mind. It's the mind that says, I am the conscious being. And the attachment is an attachment of ignorance, not an attachment of reality. Right? The me, when you say me, like say we take this statement, which is a statement of the mind makes this statement, I am a conscious being. It is referring, when it says that statement, I am a conscious being, it is referring to the conscious being experience. I am a conscious being, right? There is such a thing as a conscious being, which is me. They're just words that we're using to point to my own self-experience. Everybody see that? So now, the words, I am a conscious being, are labeling the conscious being me experience. The ignorance comes in here, where I take the conscious being, the me experience, which is the sun, to belong to the mind, because the mind says, I am the conscious being. The mind should say, you know, I'm the conscious being that illumines the mind. Then it says, when it says, I am the conscious being, the words that it is using are denoting me, the conscious being that illumines the mind. What if I say, I am the conscious being, true, which is a sangaha, which is unattached, which illumines this mind and is always the same. Right? Then it's trying to, the mind itself is trying to describe the truth, the reality of myself. It's using words, simply, to describe the situation. Now, and those words have knowledge. In other words, those words are true to, descriptively true, to my nature. Right? Now, what if the words, the same mind, it says, you know, I am the I the mind am the conscious being, and right now I am a happy conscious being, but yesterday I was a sad conscious being, you know, and I'm afraid of becoming an agitated conscious being, and eventually I'm even going to die. Okay, so... Now, those words are referring to the same conscious being, me, which hasn't been differentiated from the mind. It's not referring to a different conscious being, it's referring to me, exactly the same conscious being, but with self-ignorance, without that differentiation, right? And so Hastamalaka really is saying something so simple. He's using the sun, this illustration of the sun, which is a powerful illustration, to make you look inside, to differentiate the luminary, the conscious me, my own presence, from all of the buddhis, all of the thoughts that are being illumined, and not only that, to recognize that not only do I illumine all of these changing conditions, myself, which is non-objectifiable, is in fact the only luminary, it is the only consciousness. And it's this consciousness that I am that illumines all minds. What if you say, no, I think there can be more than one consciousness? How? How can there be more than one consciousness? You should reflect on that, because what is going to divide one consciousness from the next? For there to be two. The only things that can make for two consciousnesses are things that you, when you start analyzing your own inner experience, have already realized is not consciousness. Okay. Can be differentiated in subject-object. If I say, I illumine my body through my five sense organs, my body is not the conscious subject then. If the body is known. So I can't say there's two consciousnesses because there's many bodies. There's many consciousness, but because there's many bodies. But I don't even take my being to be this body. So that it's not a point of differentiation. And there isn't anything that's not like that. Try to think of one thing that one thing you would have to identify with as yourself, and it would have to be limited in order for there to be many consciousnesses. And what would that be? Would you even, it can't be the body, it can't be the sense organs, it can't be the mind, it can't be the thoughts in the mind, it can't be the moods, it can't be the emotions, it can't be the I thought, it can't be your collection of ignorances, it can't be your collection of knowledge, it can't be any of your relationships, right? All of these things are known, they all exist within duality, they're all illumined. It could be space. No, it can't be space, because space is also known, and I can also be without space. Space comes and goes. Shut your eyes, it's gone. It's gone from your experience. So what are we going to use to make there be two consciousnesses? We have to fall into the same ignorance. You have to be talking from the standpoint of an object, of something illumined. So this me, this conscious being that I am, once I realize, like the sun, it's a sangha. It's not attached. Right? All of the all experience within duality is coming and going and subject to continual change. Everything. Right? Everything except me. And that's the only thing. Even knowership, the knower known, seer seen, all of these things come and go. Consciousness, you can't even say consciousness is a knower. I can get rid of knowership just by going to sleep. It's the being, it's the very being, your very being, that cannot be negated or changed in any way. Now this is so important to experiment with. The experiment I like is this. It is helpful to quieten your mind and meditate and just slow everything down and just allow yourself to be with your own presence so that you can get to know your own presence, just as me, without all of the noise of the busy mind or busy world or hurt body. Just to simply relax, like we did in the meditation today, just to simply, deeply, deeply relax and just let go of everything and just be. And recognize the nature of your own self. You know, that is very useful, to just recognize that, your own presence. But then, when you are upset, or agitated, down, peaceful, happy. It's just all kinds of emotions that we go through during the day. Even busy, engaged, reading. You go through hundreds of activities throughout the day. Hundreds of mental states throughout the day. These mental states, from the most negative to the most positive, do not change you. Experientially, they change themselves. Right? I mean, of course, a negative or agitative or angry thought is not as pleasant as a happy thought. So I can have preferences, you know. So I have preferences, types of food. I like my house to be a certain way. I like my mind to be a certain way. It's preferences. But that's fine. That's not what I'm talking about. Those different conditions of mind are illumined and present to me. I don't change at all. Zero. That's the self to be recognized. The one that is exactly the same in the blissful vritti as it is in the depressed vritti. You know, maybe initially it's better to have kind of a middle range of thoughts, because the mind, you know, middle range of emotions, so that you can notice that, because the mind is so used to getting entangled with itself, where all the focus is just on the particular emotion or the particular agitation, And so the fact that I am equally present to all of them is often missed because we're so engaged in the web of our thoughts. And that's why meditation is useful, just to kind of silence that web for a while. But what is to be recognized is that me, this one who is the most dear, that which makes me me, it is never covered. You know, it's never covered at all. And it's just like in the next verse, which now we'll see next week, you know, he uses this example. If it's a cloudy day, I can look up at the sun and say, oh my gosh, the sun has lost its light. Right? From the standpoint of the sun, I am illumining the clouds. Right? So, in fact, I am illuminating the clouds. And that is my experience. Right? When we're identified with the mind, then the mind has to be in a particular condition. But, and it's fine. It's not that we don't want the mind to be. I'm not putting that down, that it's nice to have a calm mind. But that isn't the point. The point is that there's a stable self that is absolutely benign and the most beloved. It's really the self of Ishwara. It's Bhagavan. It's the whole. And that, it is that self that is present no matter what the condition of mind. And that is as experiential as the sun illumining all of the different water buckets. The sun is its own experience. I am my own experience. The sun experience is not in any way changed by the muddy water, the clear water, the agitated water, the stable water. At all. Zero. Nothing. In the same way, my being, experientially, me, what makes me, is not covered or changed in any way, no matter what the condition of the mind is. That's why what I'm suggesting is not only to have the meditative practice so that you can slow things down and just be with yourself and get to know yourself, minus all of the, you know, the agitation and the noise, but to also recognize if when your mind is not exactly quiet, who is the one that is there, that was there before? And then in the next little thought or emotion you have, who is the one that is there that hasn't changed at all, who is not being covered by these positive and negative experiences? Once the mind gets that, then what happens is that it starts enjoying the fact of that. It enjoys the fact of that. And then the mind has a home. And the home that it has is that nitya upalabhi swarupa atma, that atma whose being is consciousness, awareness, which is Ishwara, the self of Ishwara. And so it just relaxes in that self and then experiences the tumultuousness of the world. But from a totally different vantage place. It's a totally different vantage place just because of the recognition of yourself, not because it's the recognition of the stability of yourself, the same self that you had been talking about before, but only in terms, you know, of the condition of the mind. You see? Okay, so let's stop there for a minute. Then. Just take a minute. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
I think
there's even in the world of psychology, there's reasons for that. And one thing is that a state, an emotion, doesn't come and go. In other words, you can have an emotion, and then you're thinking within that emotion. And it's also very physical. Right? So it's as though the emotion is in a sense embodied, and then you're thinking out of that emotion. We could even say, emotions are more real than thoughts, and experientially, because they overwhelm, and the thoughts come out of the emotion. However, so in that way, it's more real, and you're stuck in that. Thoughts are, in a sense, if we differentiate between thought and emotion, thoughts are pretty benign. I mean, they could be good thoughts or bad thoughts, but they come and they go. That's what we call shama and dhamma. Right, a shama means shama as one of the qualities for somebody who's a dikari, qualified student for this knowledge. So shama is one of the types of ways we handle the mind. A thought comes and it goes. You don't cling to it. So scenery then, right? And so it doesn't have power over you. It's only when the mind comes and roots there, right, and becomes an affect, that then I become totally held and captured by the thought. And of course, if we look at the spectrum from positive to negative thoughts, which the happy thoughts I can rejoice in. People don't complain about those. But we really complain about the darker ones. Right? We can't just get rid of them either. Once they've entered the body, they have got their own life. We learn in psychology and even in Vedanta and other spiritual disciplines, we learn tricks and techniques to help us pass those thoughts through. But definitely we want them to pass through. You don't have that type level of engagement with a thought.
And why don't the positive ones stick like that?
That's a good question. I think, actually...
Or maybe they do and we just don't notice it.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think you spend a lot of your time just in well-being. I mean, unless there's a lot of trauma. Just well-being. You don't think about it. You're not in your own way. You're also in mind probably not focused on the being of yourself to really appreciate that, but your mind also isn't causing a lot of disturbance. And then you have extreme moments of joy and extreme moments of sorrow also.
Is it true that the mind can understand this knowledge?
Yes. I'll tell you why. I think, or do you want to say a little bit more about that? Because I kind of think I know where that question is coming from, but you might want to say some more things.
I want to hear your answer, but it's just basically I've been hanging out with different teachers, and some teachers say the mind can never understand. But from this teaching, I get that the mind can understand. So
We have to understand what understanding means, first of all. And the self, and Advaita itself, is not something that can be an object to understand. Like I can say, look at this apple, or look at this computer, and we can describe it, as an object. So it's true that the self can never become an object that we look at and describe as an object. And so if that were the end of it, it's not an object, so therefore it can't be known. That would be true if it were not the subject. But because the self is you, it's not away from you to not be able to be known. It's just the way that it needs to be known is different. It can't be known as an object, nor need it be known as an object, because you are always here. Right? Like, I need to use my mind and my sense organs to know things in the world, to accrue knowledge in the world. You know, I need the mind and sense organs because these things are not here. And so I'm dependent on the mind and sense organs to know them as objects. Myself is not an object, but it is. It's not an object, but it is. And so therefore, the means of knowledge that I have available to me from the standpoint of the Upanishads is not one of at all giving me an experience of myself. Like, now my sense organs, with the help of the mind, you know, or the mind with the help of the sense organs, gives me an experience of that painting. Without my mind and the sense organs, I can't have an experience of that painting because I'm not the painting. Right? If I go like that, I'm not having an experience of the painting. But I'm never not having an experience of myself because I am that experience. And so now what has to happen is, through use of words that we call the implied meaning of the words, we use words to point to the recognition of your own being and its relationship to the mind, for instance, and to objects in the world and to the whole. And so that way you can know and understand because you are there. That's why we say there's immediate, direct appreciation. You see the difference? If you say the mind can never know the self, well, that's true. It can never know the self as an object. But the self is there as the very being of the mind. Right? And so the mind, all the mind needs to do, it doesn't need to light up the self because the self is the conscious being that lights it up. So it needs to be differentiated from the self that is there. Right? And that self I already am. I already am experientially myself. So there's not an experience here to be gained. There's some, in fact, we say self-knowledge, which just seems like a positive term, self-knowledge. We actually say is ajnana nivritti, which ajnana means ignorance. Nivritti means the removal. What really has to happen is the removal of ignorance. Right? Because the self-experience is already here. So you just have to, and somebody says, oh, the mind can never understand the self or know the self. What do they mean by understand? What do they mean by know? You know, what do they do? Are they saying that the mind can never experience the self? Well, the mind need not be experience the self because the self is the very experience that illumines the mind. It is its own experience. Nobody's experiencing it. It is the experience.
Contrary, I think sometimes the teachings of like yoga, it's not that the mind can't experience the self. They use these techniques, as you say, the maintenance techniques or whatever, to try to experience the self when self effect is already there.
Yeah, and then there's not a shift from the avyahankara. See, we call it jada samadhi. Jada samadhi means samadhi, absorption of the mind. So there's a non-dual. Can be nirvikalpa, non-dual experience, but it's jada, it's inert, means there's no knowledge there. What that means is that you have a non-dual experience of just pure being, but the mind, when that mind comes back into duality, it then says the ahankara has not been displaced. The ahankara, which still belongs to the mind, says, oh, I, the mind, had this experience. So the identity is still with the mind, rather recognizing that it's the self that illumines the mind, right? So the hankara remains with the mind and then it seeks to have that experience again. So it goes from being a limited being to having limitless experiences and back to being limited to having limitless experience again, but not recognizing, right? So there's no knowledge that's taken place there. Many, yes. Yeah, the experience goes away, and then you think, and they'll even talk about this in some yoga shastras, you know, is that You know, I have to live my life in such a way, practice in such a way so that I can have the experience more and more and more and more with more frequency. Right? We're working to have a frequency of experience. Whereas the self is always there. It's nitya. Be free from time. There's no frequency of experience necessary here because there's no non-frequency. You know, Atma is free of change. So that needs to be recognized by the mind. And the recognition, it's not that the mind becomes a knower. The mind, because of teaching, the mind differentiates itself. Right? It's not that the mind is the conscious entity and turns around and looks at the self. So now it's conscious of the self. No. Consciousness is one consciousness, one changeless consciousness that illumines the mind. But that mind can recognize that the consciousness, which is inherent in it, I mean, inherent means the mind doesn't have any being away from that consciousness. The mind can recognize that the conscious me is not dependent on it. It can recognize that by recognizing its own nature in reference to the stability of myself.
The mind is dependent on itself.
Totally.
So the mind can recognize that.
The mind
can.
Relax
into it.
Yeah. And relax into it completely. And no matter what it's thinking or feeling or doing, it can't escape the self. You know, the stability of the self. So it's free. It recognizes the self is free. Because I am I, the self, am free. Right? And the mind now has a home, which is free and which is whole and which is complete. So the mind is free now. So it realizes, okay, I am what I am, but myself is free. Okay? And it can relax there. That's moksha. And, I mean, we go on, there's more, and that is that the source of the experience of ananda that the mind ever has is only the self, and it's caused by the relaxation of the mind. So once this problem is solved, the mind gains a level of relaxation that it didn't have before. Before it was so tied up in knots trying to make the world work, make situations work, make things be good, make my mind be this way or that way. You know, tension, stress. And so for the person who has self-knowledge, a lot of that stress goes because the mind doesn't have to worry. You know, where is its next moment of happiness going to come from?
You can choose a path of high maintenance.
Yeah. Just think of it. Where's my next moment of happiness? The mind doesn't think like that anymore. If I were to think like that, I would say to myself, for heaven's sakes, just relax. Just relax. That's all you need to do. You've gotten yourself into a mess here. Just relax. You know, it's like telling the water bucket, the muddy water bucket, no, just settle down, relax, let the silt fall to the bottom. You know, relax, you'll be fine. You know? Because the mind's experience of ananda only has to do with its relaxation that makes it more or less non-competitive with just your own being. It's like your own being reflects in a relaxed mind. Reflects means that experience of happiness is caused by that condition. But the source of that is the self. Who said?
Okay. What you said, many ignorances. In the primal analysis, there's only one ignorance. Right?
Well, we can talk about many ignorances relatively. Like, I don't know this and I don't know that. But in reference to the self, from the individual mind, there's only one self, so there's only one ignorance. But then there's all kinds of relative ignorances.
I was going to make that distinction, but it seems to me that there are many things one can be ignorant about. Things are samsara, but ignorance of those many things is just still, it seems, one thing in samsara.
You can look at it like that, but we're just talking. We can talk relatively. Like, I don't know this and I don't know that. But it's not that ignorance is some tangible thing. Though it is, in a sense, it is tangible, so I don't want to confuse you there. In terms of ignorance itself, we don't look at it as a non-existent thing because it has capacity. Like, for instance, if I don't know what really is happening, but I'm experiencing it, I'll definitely project something else on it, you know. Like, say somebody looks at you in a certain way, and you don't know what they're thinking, and it matters to you, then you'll start thinking about what they're thinking. It's all projection, the rope snake thing, you know. If you don't see the rope, but you see the form of the rope, but you don't see the rope, you see that the thisness of the rope there, you know, the bends and all of that, you experience that, but you don't experience the rope of it, you'll see it as something else. And that something else that you see could be relevant or irrelevant. It could be like a crack or a twig or something you could see it as, or you could see it as something that is a little more problematic, like a snake, you know. But you'll see it as something. You don't see it what it is. You see it, but you don't see what it is.
With reference to self-knowledge, there's only one ignorance, and you can think I need to know all these various things in order. I have these many ignorances, and therefore I need to attain any kind of knowledge in order to come to self-knowledge.
You can say all that, but in reference to the self, okay?
No, I'm saying that would be incorrect.
Yeah, that would be incorrect. However, in reference to yourself, your being is non-dual. It doesn't have parts. It is only one. It is only what it is. It's not. You can't be viewed in two ways. You can't be viewed from different angles because it has no different angles. It is really one without a second. So in reference to the self, you know, that removing that self-ignorance, so that I know my own being, that's one self-ignorance. But that self-ignorance has a myriad of manifestations in terms of how I relate to the world, how I relate to my own mind. You know, so there's all of these interrelational confusions that need to be straightened out one by one. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah.
But can they all
Well, you don't become omniscient. Like not that, so they can't all be straightened out like that. It's like, in fact, I've got to look this up to remember exactly what this verse says, but it goes like this, something like this. You know, the most dangerous person is somebody who's a master in their field. You know, they say they have mastery. In India, we say, you know, it takes at least 12 years minimum to really become a master. 12 years of concentrated devotion to a subject to achieve any level of mastery in that subject. So say you've spent your, you know, 20 years in devoted mastery of a subject. So the shloka goes something like this. Watch out for a person who has mastery in one subject because they'll think that they have mastery. Yeah, because you're used to knowing something. You know, you're used to knowing something in depth, and then you move over to another area, and you just assume that you're going to know, but you don't, in fact. Right?
Yeah, another 12 years.
On this, on the issue of the mind understanding and not understanding, can you say that the mind comes to the understanding that it's not the self, but that it's never apart from the self?
And even when you say that it's not the self, and it's never apart from the self, that's true. But now when we say it's not the self, that's not to say, once we analyze the very material of the mind, or the material of the creation, that it has any substantial being that makes it separate from the self. But within relativity, here we are experiencing all of these things that are coming and going. And these things that are coming and going, right, they can be differentiated from the self. So we say they're different from the self until we analyze them, and then we find they have no substance of their own away from.
That's the Maya.
That's the Maya, yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
What is it that perpetuates the wrong, the ignorant thinking?
It's beginningless. The ignorant thinking is beginningless. Now look at our situation. You, all of us, not just you. We're all in together. That perpetuates it too. But here we all are. We're all together within the box of the creation, experiencing the creation, all of us, through our sense organs. right? A mind which uses the sense organs. And so we're all having a and there's this relative, what we call empirical realities, you know, so that we're all, there's a shared reality here that we're experiencing through our sense organs. And there are shared laws of the creation and also shared subtle laws, emotional laws. Like, for instance, simple one. If I fulfill a desire, I become happy. You know, if I don't fulfill a desire, I'm unhappy. That's true for everybody, even animals, you know. Fulfill a desire, you're happy. You don't fulfill a desire, especially with food for animals and things like that, you know. And so say that's like something we can count on that. And so now what is the next piece of logic? Well, therefore let me fulfill all the desires that I can. Okay, but then we notice, well, if we fulfill all the desires that we can, and in doing so become a dharmic toward other people, then we don't enjoy those desires as much. And so we learn how to become dharmic. In all of the scriptures of the world, you know, the religions of the world teach us how to do that, you know, the golden rule, and then try to fulfill your desires. In other words, we are all locked in this box. And so it's going to be an unusual person, really, who breaks out of this conditioning. I fulfill a desire and I become happy. I'm kind to other people and then I have more peace than if I'm not. Okay. Everything rotates around this. So then some weirdo has to say, I mean, one in, you know, million says, what's really going on? You know, otherwise I'm going to go to heaven, or I'm going to go to hell, or I'm going to reincarnate and take birth after birth. You know, we have systems that answer our questions within the creation until you want to go a little deeper than that and say, well, why am I here? This isn't, how do I get off this cycle? Now, who is this person really? So that's very unusual. What is normal is that we're all caught into the same, you know, universe together that has an empirical reality to it.
So when we're out of that realm, is that the outside of the box then?
Well, actually, it's hard for you to get outside of the box yourself, but what you're asking, and you probably don't even know what you're asking initially, but you're just simply asking, who am I and what's really going on? If there's a God, who is that God? Who am I? What happens to me with that when I die? Is there anything that lasts? Just all of these kind of questions.
Or is there more to it than this?
Yeah, is there more to it than this? And then you realize you can't answer that. That's what makes you a mumukshu. You realize not only do you have the question, you don't have the answer. And that's when the Shastra, the Upanishads, and maybe in other traditions also, but the Upanishads say, at that time, you meet a teacher. You come together with that Upanishadic teaching. Because you need it. Right? Until that time, you don't need it. Because you have all the answers and you know what you're doing. You're just swimming along with everybody else. And you have a solution.
Marvelous meditation.
Relaxation.
Yeah.
That really creates quite insanity, you know, because if you ask a question, like, who am I, or what is this universe all about, what's my relationship with it, and you don't know that you don't know, you know, it's actually crazy. You know, if you try to do it on your own, you know, you think you should know, you know.
At some point, you know, you realize that you can't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then that really drives you crazy. That's what makes you a mumukshu. Mumukshu means literally one who desires liberation. That's what the etymology of the word means. It's a desiderative, the type of word. One who desires liberation. What they mean by that, to desire liberation, means you don't have a solution. If you desire liberation, that means you don't have a solution. It's not like desiring a car or a new job so you can be happy. You don't have a solution. That's why you look up to Bhagawan and say, if you're there, save me. Because you no longer have a solution. And it's not that you've run out of ideas. It's not that either. It's that you realize that the situation is such that it cannot be solved in terms of creating any type of stability because of the very nature of the creation. You can realize I can do this and that and this to have a good chance at maintaining, you know, a certain balance. But that's all you're doing is maintaining for a limited amount of time. So is there anything, you know, that's free of this?
Maintenance. Yeah.
Yep. Alrighty, let's stop here.